From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. 35 years ago this month, one word was on the minds and lips of American moviegoers. On June 20th, 1975, Jaws opened in theaters across the country. It starred Roy Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss, Robert Shaw, and Bruce the Mechanical Shark. In the film, the three men find themselves on an obsessive search for a man-eating great white. Well, NPR's Corey Turner recently found himself in the same boat, hunting for Bruce.
Jaws terrified me so much as a kid that it didn't occur to me the shark was fake. Then I found a photo of Bruce being built, a workman leaning harmlessly into his mouth. And that was my Heart of Darkness moment. At 10 years old, I decided, A, I had to see this Bruce for myself, and B, I had to touch him. Why? Simple. How dangerous is a shark you can touch? Here's the problem. I couldn't talk my folks into helping me track Bruce down. So I had to wait until this spring.
So this head right here measured 6 foot, 8 inches, and 400 pounds is weighed, and that's strictly the head?
That's Jeff Pertle, manager of archives and collections at NBC Universal. Universal made Jaws, and we're in Pertle's office on the Universal lot. He's showing me schematics for the original Bruces. There were actually three. One was pulled by boat, when the shark had to swim convincingly. The other two sat atop a metal arm, hidden underwater, so they could, among other things, vault onto the deck of the Orca and make short work of Robert Shaw. The width of those famous jaws? Nearly 5 feet. As for length?
That's a 20-footer.
25.
Finally, the name Bruce came from director Steven Spielberg after his lawyer, Bruce Raymer. It's hard to believe, watching the film, but Bruce the Mechanical Shark had one dirty little secret.
Wherever you were on the island, you could hear the radio mics. And they were always saying, the shark is not working.
That's Richard Dreyfuss in a documentary on the making of Jaws. Joe Alves, the movie's art director, was hired to create the shark. As Bruce's proud father, Alves admits the shark was finicky, but...
When it worked, it was just great. I mean, when it first comes out of the water, when Scheider looks and he says,
I can go slow ahead. Come on down and chum some of this.
And you look, and the shark comes up. I mean, it was just fantastic.
So what happened to Bruce? I took my question straight to the top, to Spielberg himself. Well, actually, I got his spokesman, Marvin Levy, who's been working with Spielberg since Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
The original Bruces were all destroyed.
I held out hope. Maybe there was something hiding in a warehouse somewhere, or an archive.
There's none hiding in a warehouse somewhere. There's none in an archive somewhere.
Marvin's a good guy and a straight shooter, but I thought, maybe he just didn't ask Spielberg.
I got this directly from Steven when I posed you a question.
Directly from Steven. Destroyed. But when? And why? Art director Joe Alves says by the time they finished shooting Jaws, they were so over budget and over schedule that Bruce just wasn't a priority.
We were in deep trouble. The studio was reluctant in the first place to make the movie. When we came back, they just dumped the sharks in the back lot, and they just rotted away.
Heartbroken, I went to Facebook. Believe it or not, Bruce the Mechanical Shark has his own Facebook page, and more friends than I ever will. And many of those friends still hold out hope that he's alive. I mean, intact. And it's there, on Facebook, that I first heard about a possible fourth Bruce. It sounded too good to believe, so I asked Jeff Pertle, the NBC Universal archivist.
The fourth shark was originally brought to my attention probably 2 years ago by a Jaws fan who had found my phone number and said the fourth Jaws shark was in existence at an auto parts junkyard in Sun Valley.
Now, this fourth shark was not used in the film, but it does appear to have been cast from the original Bruce mold at the time of the film, before the mold was lost. The shark hung by its tail at Universal Studios' theme park in Hollywood from 1975 to 1990. So, what happened to this fourth Bruce? I started cold calling junkyards. The conversations all went something like this. Hi, I'm calling from NPR. Do you happen to have a shark in your junkyard? Yeah, a shark. Hello? Until a few calls into my list, when the guy on the other end of the line didn't hang up on me.
I'm Nathan Adlin, Adlin Brothers Auto Wrecking in Sun Valley, California.
Nathan inherited the business from his father, Sam Adlin, who in 1990 was buying vehicles from Universal's transportation department. Now, Nathan doesn't know exactly how it happened. His father died more than 10 years ago. All he knows is, one day, lumped into a huge batch of cars at Universal, was a shark.
It caught my father's eye. I'm hearing it secondhand that when it got here, it was a little bit damaged. I think we added the teeth back to it and whatever else needed mending.
I flew across the country and headed for Sun Valley. But I had to be sure this was Bruce. So I brought a little help. The man who designed him, Joe Alves. And Alves brought his friend, Roy Arbogast, whom he had hired to help create the original Bruce mold. Nathan Adlin leads us through a compound of buildings, through a garage, and then, finally, two large gates. And there he is.
That's it.
Standing in the middle of five palm trees. In front of us is a sea of junked cars, 26 acres worth, and a tiny oasis of palms and loquat plants. In the middle of that oasis, atop two metal poles, is a shark. His skin is cracked, his color badly faded. Instead of rows of menacing teeth, he has harmless wooden dentures. But, as Joe points out, the size is right.
You know what amazes me, though, seeing it? How big the damn thing is.
But is it Bruce? Joe thinks so, but defers to Roy Arbogast. Roy walks under the belly of the beast, poking it with the handle of a rake. Then he stops and says something to himself. What was that, Roy?
That's the real one.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You're pretty sure, huh?
Yeah, definitely. It's from the same mold.
Just looking at it, can you tell me what about it strikes you?
No, it's just kind of nice to see it again after 25 or 30 years. It's amazing that it's still here.
It's older than I am, and though I'm not 10 anymore, I just can't help myself. It's too tempting. Nathan has been kind enough to give me a ladder, and we've put it just below the shark. I'm walking up the ladder. My head is officially in his mouth, and I am now touching the shark. Corey Turner, NPR News, Sun Valley, California.
And you can see a family album that we've put together of the four Bruces at our website, npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I went to Chicago's Playboy Club for my 21st birthday. We had good family friends, Auntie Abba and Auntie Jerry, who helped teach bunnies at the Chicago Playboy Club how to walk and serve food and drinks, including the famous bunny dip to ensure modesty. Being a bunny was considered good work. Hugh Hefner insisted that his customers behave. Those who didn't, be they big rollers, simple boors, or Hollywood stars, got the toss. Gloria Steinem worked at the Manhattan Playboy Club and later wrote the expose that helped make her a star in journalism. Lauren Hutton was a bunny, as was Deborah Harry, the singer, and Kimba Wood, who trained at the London Club before heading off to Harvard Law. She's now Federal Judge Wood. By the 1980s, Playboy Clubs were failing. What once seemed glamorous and daring had become hokey and degrading to women. Yet in these times, 50 years after they were invented, 22 years after they closed, Playboy Clubs are enjoying a small revival. A Playboy Club opened in Las Vegas 4 years ago. New clubs will open in Cancun and Miami this year. We're joined now by two of an estimated 25,000 women who worked as Playboy bunnies between 1960 and 1988. Nancy Downey Caddick was one of the first women to work at the Chicago Club. She's a clinical social worker at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. She joins us from WDCB in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. Ms. Caddick, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Delighted.
And Mary Chipman joins us now from WXEL in Boynton Beach, Florida. She worked in the New York and London Playboy clubs and now works for Microsoft as a computer program writer. And she's written books on programming. Ms. Chipman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
So, Nancy, and then Mary, why did you get a job at the Playboy Club?
Why? I heard it was fun, that you can make a lot of money, and I wanted it to be sort of a transition before I decided what it is I wanted to do with the rest of my life.
Well, I basically was having an adventure. I arrived in New York City with basically $6 to my name to see a friend who was writing and producing a Broadway musical, which closed after one night. And I loved New York, and I said, I got to stay here. And, of course, I didn't have any clue as to what I would do for a living. So I walked into the Playboy Club, and they hired me on the spot.
So what was it like when each of you worked at the Playboy Club, the atmosphere, if you please?
At the beginning, the atmosphere was really a private men's club. You had a very wonderful jazz music throughout. You had some great entertainers. Mm-hmm. The atmosphere was fun. It was glamorous. It was the place to be in Chicago.
Mary Chipman?
Things were quite different by the time I arrived. It was the club had seen better days. The clientele, they weren't really the high rollers. Mm-hmm. The girls who made a lot of money had been there a long time. There was a very powerful union that protected seniority. So they only had to work a couple of nights a week in the showrooms, whereas the rest of us slaved, you know, five or six nights a week, basically hanging around and hoping for people to come in so that we could make a living.
What years were you there, Mary Chipman?
I started in 71. Mm-hmm. So you had the whole women's lib thing going on as well. You know, it wasn't really that cool to be a Playboy bunny. It had been glamorous 10 years before, but it wasn't so much at that point.
And Nancy Downacadic, you were there 10 years before, right, at the Chicago Club?
Absolutely.
Let me ask you about the costumes.
Yes. The first one in the 60s was a Mary Whittle corset that they fitted you in, and they would ask your cup size, and you would tell them, and they would always go smaller. And they were tight. This costume was very tight. I have to tell you, the first time I put on the ears, I thought, oh, my. But the customers loved it. They loved the tails. And I particularly loved the cuffs and the cufflinks and the bow tie.
Wow. Mary, since you came along, Mary Chipman, at a more feminist age, had the costume changed in a way that Betty Friedan would have counseled? Or?
I loathed every aspect of that costume. I really did. It wasn't the sexiness of it, which was okay. It was the whole idea of the ears and the tail. I just thought it was very degrading. And once you make yourself into this bunny, which isn't really a woman, it's kind of just this hybrid creature, people felt entitled to take liberties with you. People would feel entitled to pull your tail or touch you. Of course, the management would protect you from all of this, but, you know, still, that was the natural impulse. You know, the usual social barriers of treating women with a certain amount of respect mm-hmm. were somewhat dissolved by the costume, I felt.
What I found most difficult to handle at the club was not men, it was women. So I would have a couple of incidents where a woman would pull my tail. Another one who would just continue to make all kinds of nasty statements to me as I'm trying to serve them. And nothing I did seemed to please her. And so I mentioned it to my colleagues, and I said, I don't know what to do. And another one said, I do. And so what we did is I set up a tray of sticky drinks like Brandy Alexander
grasshoppers. Yeah.
And so I would head toward the table and someone would be coming the other way and they would tip my tray and it landed in her lap.
Oh.
And of course she was screaming and carrying on. And of course the room manager apologized. And I thought, well, she may not come back again, but if she does, maybe she'll rethink how she communicates with bunnies.
Yeah. We're speaking with Nancy Downey-Caddick and Mary Chipman, both one-time Playboy bunnies. The Playboy Clubs turned 50 this year. Nancy Caddick, you're a clinical social worker, and you have specialized in treatment with HIV/AIDS patients. Mary Chipman, you're a software writer and computer programmer. People sometimes surprised to learn what you used to do?
I don't tell them.
Really? Why?
I have kept it basically, you know, a secret for years. It doesn't do you any good, really. The industry I work in is a very young industry. Most of the people I work with are so much younger, they have no idea what it was. It's a curiosity. Kind of dates you. But as I've gotten older, my perspective on that has softened, and I just don't care anymore. You know, I had a colorful, adventurous life, and that was one part of it, and that's who I was, who I am. But it doesn't do you any good to put it on your resume.
Nancy Cannon?
I have a different experience. Now, years later, in community services and having gone to school, I was applying for a position at Northwestern Memorial. This is before I'm a social worker. And the position was for an office manager in respiratory therapy. And I decided to put my years as a bunny on the bottom of the resume. I got a call that afternoon. I got an interview the next day. And I was hired that day because they liked my looks. And this particular manager had fond memories of Playboy.
What might you tell women working as bunnies now?
I wish I had had a more playful attitude about my bunny experience at the time. I think I took myself way too seriously.
You know, life is too short. Have fun. I really believe that women should have those adventures before they're 30 or whatever age, but they should have those adventures that you can look back and be pleased. Who we are is a combination of all these experiences. These are great stories to tell my grandchildren and to have a feeling at the end of life that one has really had a view of it.
Boy, I've enjoyed talking to both of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
Mary Chipman and Nancy Downey-Caddick. Next week, Playboy Clubs will have 50 parties in 50 cities to celebrate their 50th anniversary. And the July issue of the magazine pays tribute to the bunnies' past and looks to the future of the clubs. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The word is stromer. It's a medical instrument. Don't worry, I had to look this up too, that measures the amount and speed and flow of blood through an artery. Anamika Veramani, 14 years old, from North Royalton, Ohio, spelled stromer to win the 2010 Scripps National Spelling Bee last night. There was some controversy. By the way, is that S-Y or S-E-Y? The judges put six contestants into the final round, even though they didn't spell a word in the semifinal round, to guarantee 10 finalists to fill a two-hour television spelling bee special. Anamika Veramani won $40,000 in cash and prizes. She told reporters she wants to go to Harvard and become a cardiovascular surgeon, where she can say, "Hand me that stromer. Stat!" This is NPR News.